Small businesses are grappling with the impact of these uncertain times and looking for resources. That's why Dell Technologies assembled an all-star lineup of podcasters to create the first-ever virtual conference to share advice and inspiration for small businesses. Dell Technologies is here, from keeping you connected while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams to providing relevant content for businesses. Search Dell Technologies Small Business Podference on radio.com, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts starting May 1st.
For the perfect scam, I'm your host, Michelle Kosinski.
And I'm Frank Avagnale.
Frank has played a doctor, a lawyer, a pilot, and now he's playing a podcast host. He joins me, along with other top fraud experts, to share some of America's biggest scam stories.
Somebody's always going to be trying to come up with a new scheme. It's just too much money to be made easily.
Frauds, scams, con artists, shocking tales of deceit. You name it, we got it all. The perfect scam from AARP.
Say you listen to Dr. Birx talking there about testing. The president announced yesterday that we have done more testing than France, the United Kingdom, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, India, Austria, Australia, Sweden, and Canada combined. So it seems as though the United States is well on its way to getting testing under control. Curious as to what your opinion is on how we're doing here, Doctor. What do you think?
Well, I think we are testing a lot of people, but I still think we're lagging a little bit behind. You know, again, we're testing people who tend to have by pretty strict criteria. So we're essentially sort of isolating those people out that are sicker and meet the diagnostic criteria and then testing them. You know, the molecular testing, this PCR testing that's largely touted is as sort of the gold standard is still being ramped up. I think we've tested as of yesterday, I believe it was about 53,000 people in the state of Missouri. And you think you hear that number, you think, boy, it sure would be nice if we could test a lot more, certainly people with milder or moderate symptoms to try and really identify where we are. So it is clearly ramping up from where it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. Some of that's the capacity of just the equipment and the reagents and getting people tested. Hopefully, as we move a little more towards these antibody tests as potentially a triage or a screening tool to identify potential positives, and then you can then utilize your molecular testing to confirm that testing, the results of the antibody test as well. So we've got some work to do on testing. My personal opinion, and I think shared by a lot of physicians and logical thinking individuals, is the more people we can test to really get a sense of who's been exposed, who did have mild symptoms or asymptomatic, and who are acutely ill, that gives us just more data to work with and can really change the numbers what we're looking at.
So we're speaking with Dr. Hardiman here. He's a physician, and he's with Urgent Specialists. So when we hear the term testing, does testing only test people who have symptoms, who come in and want to get a test? Or are we talking about antibody tests? Are we talking about, like, what is all included when people are saying we need more testing?
So there's basically two types of tests that are being discussed largely, the molecular testing or the PCR test, which is largely what is being used. It's the CDC standard test that then was moved out to state health departments and some hospitals as well that were designed off of the original CDC test. The antibody tests are different. So the molecular testing are looking for the genetic makeup or RNA of the virus. And then the antibody tests are really looking at the individual's own innate immune response to that virus. So the both tests have to have there's variability that comes with this. No test is perfect. Nothing is 100%. It is true with a molecular test that if you get a good sample, then you can, you see the results, you can really believe them with a high level of validity, but there are phases where the virus may not be largely present enough as a viral load to detect. Depends on where patients are in their symptom cycle. As well, the antibody test the same way. Usually, most antibodies begin to ramp up about 3 days post-exposure, and you should be able to follow those. But all of these have some potential cross-reactivity with some of the other coronavirus strains that are out there. Although it's a low percentage, that the tests are getting much more valid all the time. And so, in reality, I think the molecular testing is going to be our gold standard, but the antibody test should be this triage mechanism out in the field. And there's a number of companies that are ramping up producing those now, which is a little bit of a quagmire with just FDA emergency use approval, as well as what HHS is recommending as the gold standard test. But the good companies that are kind of rising to the surface are going to be reporting that data to the FDA, and hopefully we'll be able to get more information as to the prevalence in the community.
Dr. Hardiman, I don't expect you to know a lot about nationwide supply chains or anything like that, but is this a particularly difficult virus to test for? Is that what's slowing things down?
No. So the backstory is dating back after the first of the year, China, I don't remember the exact date, but sometime I believe it was in January, early February, released the genetic makeup of the virus, and the CDC started down the path of producing the assay to do to evaluate that. Now that we have that genetic sequence, that's pretty clear cut. The lateral flow tests are these pinprick antibody tests that are out there now that what we've been talking about. Similar concept. They have to have there's specific proteins that are represented, and you have an antibody response to that. And so they develop the reagents. It's very similar to what a strep test is like on the back of the throat, or when you do an influenza swab, except this is done off of blood. It's a test where you're looking for the antibody response to it. So if the information is there now, I think it's more just trying to make sure that they're as sensitive and specific as possible. You don't want to have a bunch of false negatives. You don't want to have a lot of false positives either. But we only are really going to know that when you start to correlate symptoms with antibody testing, with PCR testing or molecular testing. But a good clinician and logical thinking individuals will look at a person and say, well, you're testing negative, but you look sick. Let's reevaluate you in 24 hours or 48 hours. So it's not just here's your results, you're good to go. It's something that you have to use good clinical acumen for. So I think the methodology is pretty well founded now. It's just a matter of determining the validity to it and just trying to get as many tests done as possible. And that's the only way you're really going to know and confirm what's going on.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman. He is a Gateway ENT physician. He is also a physician with Urgent Specialists, online at urgentspecialist.com. What is your recommendation? Like, what do you want people to know about how this spreads, how coronavirus spreads now that we're, I don't know, 6 weeks? I don't even know. I've lost track of time.
Yeah, I've lost track too.
It's been a long time. So when you... disinfecting our groceries when we bring our groceries home, especially the stuff I put in the freezer, because you told us last week that's maybe, I thought, I'll just throw in the freezer and eat it in 2 weeks, it'll be fine. And you're like, that's a great way to preserve the virus. Well, good to know. What are things, lifestyle changes that people need to be doing, or maybe things that you've seen people doing that maybe aren't really as helpful as they are intended to be?
Well, this virus is transmitted a number of different ways. It is a respiratory illness, and it does have the ability to live on inanimate things for, question mark period of time. I've seen things as short as a few hours to as much as a few days, but it can live on inanimate things. And so the important thing is really good personal hygiene. If you're cautious when you're out and about and you're touching things that might have potential viral particles on it, don't touch your face, constantly wash your hands or using some sort of quality hand sanitizer. Masks are, have become the latest hot button issue to talk about. I mean, obviously the CDC is recommending masks out in the community, and I think there is some validity of if you're sick to not pass the, if you're coughing, that you're not going to be passing respiratory droplets as much if you're wearing a mask. They do an awful lot, too, to remind us not to touch our face and keep our hands around them, too. And certainly in the healthcare environment, it's extremely helpful to have masks on to try and decrease the spread of illness. But, when you're wearing a mask in public, you really are kind of helping the community by you masking yourself in case you were potentially asymptomatically spreading virus. It does slow those respiratory droplets a bit. So personal hygiene is really key. I mean, and you see people, I had to run out this morning, and you see folks at the store and they have masks on, they're being careful, they're carrying hand sanitizer. I think people are cautiously standing apart from one another to give people a little bit of distance in case someone is coughing. But I think it's important to remember that while there are asymptomatic spreaders of this, and that percentage actually is potentially fairly high, could be as much as 25% of people don't really have symptoms. Through casual respiration and breathing in and out, yes, you can move virus through the air, but it's much more likely, and your viral load is much higher, I should say, if you're coughing and have a lot of secretions, and if those, if you're in the proximity of someone like that, obviously a little more distance is important. But when you're exposed as an individual, the virus is pretty contagious, more so than common flu or common cold. But it still takes a certain element of viral load, and there's pretty good evidence that the more exposure you have, the more potential reaction or symptoms you're going to experience afterwards, too. So the distancing makes sense, trying to be extremely judicious with personal hygiene and, wearing masks. There's some validity to that to try and prevent, you from passing the virus to other people and to try and keep you from touching your face as well.
We were, my husband and I were out, we went to the Starbucks drive-thru, was our big outing yesterday. And on our way back, we were just amazed. First of all, it was an absolutely gorgeous day. So the Lowe's parking lot, jam-packed. Walmart's parking lot, jam-packed. And we just drove through the parking lots, and I counted 33 people that I saw, and I saw 8 people wearing masks. So I figure roughly 25% of my very non-scientific study there of what I was seeing taking place of people coming in and out of Walmart and of Lowe's and some other stores that were in between there. If only 25% of people are wearing masks, that is that better than nothing?
Boy, that's a tough question to answer. You know, it's hard to not just agree with what the CDC says out there, and they're recommending wearing masks. Scientifically and realistically, I think there's, you know, masks are helpful, and like I said, in some capacity to prevent you from passing something to someone else. But, you know, if you're across the store from someone or 20 feet away from someone who's not wearing a mask, I don't think you have a whole lot to be concerned about in that case, because that person is not directly breathing on you, just as if you've had a family member that has a cold and you don't catch the cold, even though you're living in the same house. Again, this is more contagious than a common cold, but your point is very valid. You know, we're kind of approaching this as an all or none theory right now, that, you know, let's shelter at home, let's all wear masks, let's do all these things. But in reality, this isn't going to go away anytime real soon. We're looking at months of potentially having this virus in the community. And so as we start to crawl out, or this veil gets lifted here, and we start to have less of the social distancing, when you know, my practice can see more patients, when we can start doing more elective surgeries, et cetera, we still have to be diligent to be mindful of all of the potential contamination or exposure that. So you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't know that I have a great answer to that. I think probably some is better than none, but if nothing else, maybe just keeps it on our forebrain so that we're still acutely aware of our own personal hygiene space around other people like that.
All right. Well, I want to take a quick break. Dr. Scott Hardiman's going to stay with us during the break, and our Facebook Live is back up and running because Katie spent all of that time in the back, and she has managed to fix it. So ask your questions of the doctor there on our Facebook Live at facebook.com/AnnieFryShow, and we will work them in the next segment. You can also tweet Ryan at Radio Wiggins, and he can include those questions. And I'm going to ask you when we come back about this term I keep hearing, herd immunity, what kind of value you set in that. So we're going to have that as soon as we come back. More with Dr. Scott Hardiman and the expert when it comes to the coronavirus. Back in just a minute.
You're listening to The Annie Fry Show.
When you consider that we have, as a country, not run out of ventilators in any one place, we've been able to either move them around or acquire enough, do you think that this initial effort to socially distance, is it more about making it so that the hospitals can handle it, or is it about beating coronavirus? What's the point of the whole flattening the curve effort that we've been making?
Sure. You stated it perfectly. It really is to try and not put ourselves in a position where we don't have enough medical supplies or capacity to take care of patients. So it's not about trying to eradicate this particular illness. It's about trying to make sure that we have adequate supply, equipment, beds, and staff, quite frankly, the doctors, nurses, and everyone in the healthcare profession, first responders, to be able to handle the influx of patients is there. And it seems to be working. And for certain, I can speak to just St. Louis and the state of Missouri, is that our hospitals are definitely not at capacity. And we kind of had plateaued last week when we spoke. There's been a little bit of an uptick, which has kind of come through some nursing home population that have become more infected. But, you know, the idea is to try and have the capacity spread out over a period of time, slow the transmission of the disease enough that we have adequate supply to take care of them.
Doctor, so when it comes to herd immunity, is there going to be a point where we do need to get other people back out in, like, healthy people to participate in life as we at least used to know it, with some modifications, certainly? But is it important that more people are out there to help build some sort of herd immunity that would have to require us to be more exposed?
Right. So herd immunity is the implication that there is enough of the population, a large enough proportion, that have been either become immune through exposure and fighting infection off, or through vaccination, that it breaks the transmissible chains of an illness. So effectively, there's just less people that are going to get it or have it to pass it to people that aren't necessarily immune. And as a result of that, you see that herd immunity effect really start to slow the transmission at that point. But no one exactly knows where that number is, but I think back from medical school, they told us around 2/3 of the population or so, once you have some level of either passive or immunity induced by vaccine, that you would be able to see that herd immunity effect kick in. What's a little unknown, I would say, about this is how long does your immunity last? In theory, once you've been exposed to something like this, you should have protective antibodies for a fairly prolonged period of time. But as we see, for instance, with influenza, you have to have a booster vaccination every year or a vaccine to try and reboost that immune system. Some of that has to do with the change in strain that's there. And there's a little bit of evidence that this particular virus may be going through some mutation. But it seems as if at least in the near short term, maybe 60, 90 days or so, there should be some immunity to it long term. Again, hopefully we'll have a little better sense of that once we do more antibody testing. And if we could just sort of wave a magic wand and you could test 100% of your population, we saw that 65 or 66% of them had some long-term antibody towards this particular virus, I think we'd all feel a collective sigh of relief at that point to think, well, at least there's something that helps. Hopefully, if there's anything that I would like to personally see just from as a practicing physician is that we certainly continue to focus our care on the people who are acutely ill and very sick, but if we could shift our focus out into the community, you know, get out into the battlefield, not when they're already arriving at the hospital, and really identify people who have mild to moderate symptoms or testing positive, really watch those people in case their symptoms progress, but potentially even get them on some early treatment early on to prevent them from progressing and getting sicker. Talk about flattening the curve. If you can keep people out of the hospital and needing to go on a ventilator, you've really flattened the curve at that point.
Dr. Hardiman, the big treatment news this week was remdesivir. The stock market certainly liked it. What's the excitement medically? Where do we stand with that drug?
So they've been using that really since the get-go. I think that drug's produced by Gilead Pharma, and it's gone through a couple of early trials that show some promise. Again, trials on these are tricky because, you're treating the sickest of the sick. We've been kind of in a reaction mode to most of this management at this point. There's starting to be a little more prospective studies or prophylactic studies out there of some oral medications like the hydroxychloroquine and some other combinations of medications. Remdesivir is an antiviral medication, and along with some other drugs seems to be showing some promise early on. But, you know, if you're really going to – the tricky part is you have these folks that are literally dying in the hospital or we're trying to keep them from ending up in, you know, complete pulmonary failure. You really just don't want to try almost anything on them at that point. And so when you're that sick, it's awfully hard to really get great data as your endpoint long term, if they recover or not, if they don't recover, what they're specifically testing. But it certainly, that along with many other things, seems to be pretty promising at this point.
I'm sure you saw the same study that we all did last week at the end of the week about the homeless shelter that they tested everybody within, and the infection rate was way higher than they thought it was, but nobody was showing symptoms. What do you think that means for the general population, a study like that?
Well, if you could, you know, use common sense and extrapolate that to general population, that gets us a lot farther down the path to this potential herd immunity that exists that we've been talking about. So I think there was a study out of California that looked at that as well. So there's percentages from 0.1 to 7% of the population to as much as 10 or 20% of populations in these isolated groups like that where they're testing, they've shown up positive and are asymptomatic. The concern about, well, I guess I would question, and I don't specifically remember this and what you're referring to, was how they determined that they were positive. Was it off a molecular test or an antibody test? So the antibody test can be positive, but you have to drill down a little further. Is it short-term positive, as in their symptoms are just ramping up, or is it positive in that they've had the infection in the past and they've still got some circulating antibodies that should be protective at that point? The only way you would really know for certain where that is to either quantitatively measure their antibodies versus just are they present, are they not, but to get an actual measure of how much there is, or to do a follow-up molecular test on them. And so a positive result with both short-term and long-term antibodies, if you can follow that with a molecular test and it comes back negative, then you would tend to put that patient in that convalescence group. So I don't recall from that particular paper or study what they were using as their endpoint of being positive, but moral of the story is, I think most people are starting to see these studies and become a little more cognizant of the fact that it's probably more prevalent in our community than we think. The number that we keep coming back to is about 25% of people are thought to be asymptomatic spreaders. That number may be higher. And as much as 40% or more of people don't have any symptoms at all or very mild respiratory type symptoms. And it's masquerading as a lot of different things. The criteria for molecular testing is still pretty strict. A lot of shortness of breath, fever, potential travel areas. Those patients are going to probably turn up positive. But what we really want to find are those folks in the community that for data to know what the real numbers are, but also to identify them before they get sicker.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman. He is a physician at Gateway ENT, also with Urgent Specialists, online at urgentspecialist.com. Anybody who listens to the show with any regularity knows that I have a special place in my heart for Disney World. It's a wonderful place to go spend time with your family. And I think that watching closely how they are reacting to this, certainly they're taking a gigantic economic hit having to close. And I'm interested in watching how they're reacting, because I don't think Disney is going to open one day too soon, but they are not going to open. They're not going to wait past the time that it's okay. So in my opinion, they're going to take into consideration everything that's necessary. And when they open up, they're going to believe that they have put in place the measures that are going to make it safe for guests to come back to one of the most visited places in the world. My question to you is, I would assume at least that whenever a company like Disney World has to make that decision, or a major sporting organization, they're going to have to take into consideration everything they can, but there's still going to always be a risk. And there always was a risk. Maybe it wasn't coronavirus, but this isn't the first thing that has been contagious, that has been spread at very populous places, where maybe in the past we haven't practiced the best hygiene collectively as a community. Do you anticipate places like that, sporting events, to reopen, with the understanding at some point that they're doing the best that they can, and then the guests that are coming, the fans, the people, the travelers, they're just going to have to weigh the risk themselves going forward as to whether or not they want to participate?
Yeah, I do. I think to that point, there's this, like I said, this isn't going away anytime real soon. We hope to see that it levels off and declines and getting into phase one and phase two of ramping back up. I think the plan is likely to be this graduated approach. So getting to the point where you're opening a sports venue or a Disney World or Disneyland or any theme park, you know, that may be a while down the road. You know that big organizations like that are going to do their homework, and they've got a lot of experts that are weighing in to give them guidance on when and how, and you'll probably see a lot of behavioral modifications. But, you know, we're a country that has freedoms, and we want to be able to continue to have those freedoms and not lose our civil liberties. And there's a personal responsibility there that, you're right, folks will look at this and say, I'm going to weigh the risks, and I'm going to take precautions for myself using hand washing or et cetera, the things we've talked about. And at some point, we'll have to open up society to do that. So my guess is that they will measure the risk and mitigate that risk as much as possible, but there is a point in time where we're going to have to get out there again. And that's, you see that. I mean, you go into your local grocery store, I think one of the kind of amazing parts of this is that we're all trying to assimilate this information, this and misinformation, and then do what we can to try and not expose our staff, our employees, or the public and what have you, you know, putting up screens in front of people at grocery stores. All of these things are people's efforts to say, we want to do our part, we want to try and slow this down, but we've got to continue to try and have the world moving forward in the economy, and hopefully that happens sooner than later. The cure may be worse than the disease, as they've been saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Scott Hardiman, it's a pleasure to have you on here. Got some other questions that we want to get to you next time we have on here from some listeners who just put them in there, and we will do so. We appreciate you so much. Thanks for your expertise.
Thank you all very much. You take care.